It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, our guest says adults should support young girls in activist efforts and makes the case that it's good for both girls and their communities.
First, Wisconsin's voter ID law has been in court this week with a hearing before a federal judge. The hearing focused on the way the law was put into practice, especially when it comes to people having special difficulties getting valid photo identification.
Today, the judge in the case issued an order to the state to fix things up, but left the law in place. WPR Capitol reporter Laurel White was there. She joins us now from our studio at the state capitol. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the end of the hearing, Laurel. What did U.S. District Judge James Peterson say the state needs to do between now and Election Day?
Well, the judge is ordering the state to update some public education documents and to create some new documents. Basically, he wants the state to update a handout that they've been giving to people that enter this petition process to get an ID. And he wants them to create a new document, just kind of a one-page explainer for people who might be interested in entering the process, to tell them what they need to do so, what to expect if they do, and what they can expect to take away at the end of it. The judge, in addition to those documents, is also calling for an expanded public education campaign about voter ID and this petition process in particular.
And that gets at kind of the initial reason that we had these hearings, the idea that people with special circumstances getting an ID, they were going to their DMV office and getting different information and often wrong information. Is that right?
Well, there were some recordings that came out late last month. They were released by a voter education group called Vote Riders. They were audio recordings that they say were taken when they went into the DMV, different DMV offices across the state, with people trying to enter this petition process or just get an ID. And it became clear that they would need to enter this petition process. And what they say these recordings reveal is that DMV workers haven't really been on the same page. They've been giving out information that's inconsistent or, in some cases, inaccurate. So after those reports came out, after those recordings came out late last month, Judge Peterson asked for a state investigation into those allegations and then had this hearing yesterday to go over that information.
So Judge Peterson says more outreach, updated voter information cards in a way. Does he think that this is going to solve the problems that they're seeing out there?
He really doesn't. The way that he characterized it in the courtroom today, everyone gathered again this morning to hash out the final details. He said that what we're doing here is patching it up. It's basically getting the voter ID law in good enough shape, that was his phrase, to get us through the November election.
We're talking to WPR Capitol reporter Laurel White about the last 2 days of hearings over Wisconsin's voter ID law, new demands, new rules from U.S. District Judge James Peterson. What did representatives of the state have to say at these hearings, Laurel?
Well, the state lawyers for the state called just a couple people for their defense. They called State Elections Administrator Mike Haas, and they also called the administrator of the State Division of Motor Vehicles. And essentially what that testimony was meant to do was to just say, this is the process we have in place. It's an adequate process. This is the voter education we've done thus far. Here's what it's entailed. So Judge Peterson could kind of weigh what the state has been doing, or what the state says it's been doing, and with what some of those allegations were about, you know, some misinformation possibly getting out there and some confusion.
Now, Judge Peterson is in on this in the first place, in part because of a lawsuit from the Group One Wisconsin. They're the plaintiffs here. What did they have to say in response to Judge Peterson's ruling today?
Right. Well, those are the plaintiffs that brought this case. They filed their paperwork way back in 2015 challenging the voter ID law and a handful of other election laws. And I was able to catch up with one of their lawyers after the hearing today. And I believe we have some tape of what one of their lawyers had to say.
Right. Josh Call here, lawyer for the plaintiffs.
We were very pleased with the judge's order. He ordered a lot of reforms that we think are going to help make it easier for people to access the right to vote and be able to get the IDs they need to vote.
Now, initially, as you mentioned, One Wisconsin was challenging the voter ID law itself. It sounds like they're coming into these hearings hoping to renew that idea of saying, let's take voter ID back off the table even for the election next month. Did Judge Peterson, that didn't happen. It's still in place. Did Judge Peterson talk about that today?
That's exactly right. That's what the plaintiffs were hoping to accomplish with this new hearing. They called for the judge to strike down the entire voter ID law in light of these new allegations about some misinformation being out there. And that is not what happened, of course. Judge Peterson did not strike down the entire law. He made that clear from the beginning of the hearing yesterday. He said, "It's clear to me I don't have the authority to issue a new injunction on the voter ID law." And he didn't think it would be wise for a number of reasons for him to do so, including how close it is to the November election.
Right. The election is a month off. Judge Peterson has told the state more outreach, more better, actually, information handed out to people who need these ID petitions. Is he dusting off his hands, done with this until Election Day, or is he going to be checking in?
He is going to be checking in. He's actually calling for the state to give him weekly updates to update him on how they're complying with this order. And the things that he's hoping to be updated on will be updated on. The state says it's going to comply with his order. They're not going to seek an appeal. He's going to get information about the rollout of these education campaigns, the new documents. And he also wants information on spot checks at DMV offices across the state to ensure that DMV workers are providing these new documents, providing accurate information.
The lesson, the information that voters need now is we do need voter ID at the polls, and better information will be showing up at DMVs to help us get this voter ID. Is that the take home for voters?
Exactly. Make sure that you have an ID to go in and vote. And if you go into your local DMV to get an ID, if you don't have one already, they should have robust information available for you starting on Monday. That's when these new documents are supposed to be available statewide.
Barring some other court change, that's how it's going to be until this election. Is there any indication from Judge Peterson about more action needed after November for future elections?
Well, of course, we're expecting more news on voter ID in Wisconsin after November. The case that Judge Peterson is involved with, you know, he issued his ruling in July. That ruling has been appealed to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. There's also another ongoing federal trial on voter ID that's also been appealed to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. So there could be more changes after November, certainly, but it is looking like what is in place right now is what is going to be in place for November.
Laurel, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White talking about a two-day federal court hearing on the state's voter ID law. When 17 Magazine agreed to stop photoshopping their models, a 13-year-old activist, Julia Bloom, was behind that effort. Also, if you're noticing more diverse Google doodles on your computer screen on your homepage, you can give credit to the activist work of teenager Celeste Montano.
Our guest makes the case that activism is good for not just girls, but also for schools and the wider community. But she says it's important that older women, teachers, parents, and mentors know how to support girls in that activism.
For example, she rejects the lean-in approach we've heard a lot about lately and instead offers what she calls a field guide to supporting young activists.
Lynn Michael Brown joins us now. She is professor of education and director of women's gender and sexuality studies at Colby College in Maine. She's also founder of three grassroots organizations, the Spark Movement, Powered by Girl, and Hardy Girls Healthy Women. Her new book is called Powered by Girl, a field guide for supporting youth activists. Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Lynn, a big part of the reason that you wrote this book is the concern that the idea and the experience of girl power, girl activism is being commodified, and it's also being driven by this notion of sort of the single exceptional girl. What do you see happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I've been noticing this not only because of the work I've done with girl activists. You mentioned the 17 Action and the Google Action. Those were accomplished by a group of girls working with adult allies and a lot of partner organizations to do that work. And we noticed over and over again that the way media sort of, you know, talked about these issues were to kind of pick out one girl and to really highlight her story and her specialness and her kind of uniqueness. And it sort of, it was really frustrating. In fact, Julia Bloom, who did the 17 magazine, stopped talking to media unless they would acknowledge that this was a collective coalition. you know, doing the work, and she started talking about media as photoshopping the action in the way that they, you know, photoshop girls' images, but just sort of focusing on the one girl, which really doesn't tell the full story, and by not telling the full story, it really doesn't give the girls listening or watching the information they need to do the same kind of work.
Why do you think that's happening? Why is there a temptation for the media to just pluck out this one single girl from a team of other activists and supporters and just shine a spotlight on her?
Yeah, I just think it makes a compelling story, right? And they're often, you know, young girls. I mean, Marley Diaz, who did sort of the 1,000 Black Girl Books action, was, I think, 11. You know, Julia was 13. Rachel Parent, who did work on GMOs, started when she was 8. And I just think that's a really compelling story. These young girls who seem to, like, have it all together and be just so incredibly accomplished. And, you know, that's a unique story. It's not such a great story to say that they worked with adults, that they worked with a coalition of partner organizations. And in reality, that makes them really savvy activists because that's how you get stuff done. But it doesn't make for the same kind of story.
And there is sometimes a generational difference when younger women and older women relate to each other. And when we're talking about these communities around activists, you say that it is really important that these young women are supported and that there is this intergenerational play that goes on. How do you suggest that happens, that older women and young activists work together?
Well, I think older women, I include myself, really have to appreciate the fact that girls are experts on their own experience, that their experiences now are very different than ours growing up. And so in order to do this work, we have to be able to listen. We have to be humble. And we have to, you know, allow them to sort of take the lead. I mean, I see our role as adults as sort of scaffolding, you know, in the way that a building is scaffolded. So you provide support as needed, but the hope is that the girl will, and the group of girls will sort of be able to kind of lead the project forward. And some of that support falls away and when they're ready. So it's not that, you know, girls don't lead and don't do amazing things, but nobody does social change work on their own, not really effective change work.
You've said that right now the stars are sort of aligning for young feminists. Why do you think this is a good time to be a young feminist?
Well, their pop stars are claiming feminism and they're claiming activism, and girls are seeing this everywhere. You know, there's a lot of sexism in the air right now and racism, and I think a lot of issues that really compel girls, and they really want to be part of making the world a better place, making it the kind of world they really want to live in. And so I think there is a lot of energy, and that's my experience working with girls, is they are so ready to do this work, but they just are not getting the information about how to connect and how to sort of work in coalition and how to build actions together.
Do you think that's different from other generations that might have also had this sort of upsurge of young feminists?
I think it's, you know, it's similar in some ways. And I think back to the Riot Girl movement in the 90s, where young women were sort of joining punk bands and writing fanzines and really pushing back on sexual violence and sexism and reclaiming the word girl to be a power word. You know, and that work, too, got kind of commodified and, you know, became Spice Girls, became, you know, girl power products for, you know, a generation. And so I feel I get concerned when girl activism gets commodified in a similar way, because I feel like if it's going to be driven by the market, it's going to be driven by the lowest common denominator, and it's going to be non-threatening. And the way these girls are written about in media is very, you know, they're very smiley and non-threatening. And in fact, they're very, in real life, angry about things and assertive and, you know, willing to sort of take risks. But that's really not the story that gets told.
We're talking with Lynn Michael Brown right now from Colby College in Maine, talking about her book, Powered by Girl, a Field Guide for Supporting Youth Activists. And you just used the word angry. And that's something that, you know, historically women were not supposed to be. Do you think that in this new world of girl activism, there's a place for being outspoken and loud and, yeah, maybe angry too.
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know, psychologists and philosophers, if you look at the literature, you know, really talk about anger as a political emotion, you know, that you really need to identify what it is you feel strongly about in order to sort of be motivated to do social change work. I think that's always been the case, but I think there's right now a real liveliness about and a real openness about girls' voices and strong feelings, and it feels like it's a moment of incredible potential.
Do you think that has to come from within the activist community, that sense that it is okay to be loud and angry and have ideas and, you know, be some things that girls historically were not supposed to be? Or is it something that the broader culture has to support, you know, at least in tandem?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's important for girls to sort of be part of coalitions who really can support their strong feelings about an issue. I mean, a coalition is a group of people working across difference who have a real similar goal in mind. And for girls to be part of that, it makes them feel like their strong feelings and their risk-taking, their anger is, you know, it's supported. They have company, and that's really important. I think it's more important than having sort of being able to please people, you know, outside of the group or whatever, or to have sort of the broader cultural, the culture be supportive, I think.
Now, you yourself, you founded three of these girl-powered grassroots organizations. One is Spark, there's Hardy Girls, Healthy Women, and Powered by Girl 2. What do you do in these groups that you think is getting at this activism in the right way?
Well, I think what we do is we bring girls together, again, across difference. It's really important for girls to sort of get to know and experience different perspectives. I mean, you know, and I'm talking about racial difference and gender nonconformity, and just really having girls have the experience of different voices, different people working on the same cause. And I think it having adults who are really loyal to them, you know, who are willing to build genuine relationships. And when the going gets tough, they really stand with girls. And, you know, a lot of girls have experiences growing up of, you know, adult betrayal, you know, of sort of people who say they're there and when push comes to shove, they're not. I think it's also, you know, offering girls, you know, a sense of, you know, coalition, as I said, and really respecting their knowledge and their expertise and what they bring to these issues. So I think in our groups, we really try to be honest and genuine in our thoughts and feelings. And, you know, sometimes girls are challenging us, you know, challenging us because of the compromises we've made as adult women. And we have to stay in that and stay in those conversations. And I think that's kind of a unique experience for girls. They just don't have that opportunity very often with women.
What kind of things do they challenge you on?
Oh, they challenge us on our, you know, definition of feminism. I mean, I've been pushed over the years to really understand, you know, intersectionality and, you know, gender nonconformity and trans issues. And, you know, I've learned a ton by just being with girls, working with girls, engaging with them, you know, arguing with them. And, you know, my daughter as well, who's been in some of these organizations, has, you know, really pushed me to think about, you know, how I understand the work I'm doing. So I think that when they push us at the very heart of the matter, that's the tough stuff, and that's when we really have to stay present.
Are we talking about an extended activist, you know, family of just other women, or are we talking about men and women?
Yeah, I think we're talking about men and women. I think we're talking about adults and youth. I mean, I work primarily with girls and women who are working with girls in the nonprofits I've developed and organizations. But I absolutely think this has to be, you know, we're all in this, right? I mean, we all have to be working on sort of making the world a more just and caring place.
Do you think what you're talking about could be seen as sort of a counterballast to what some people like the writer Peggy Orenstein has called the pornification of society, sort of this excessive focus on sexuality, especially for girls?
Yeah, I think it's so key. And I love Peggy's work, and I feel like, you know, there was this really interesting study a few years back by a psychologist, and the title was Objects Don't Object, you know, and it was about sort of evidence showing that self-objectification sort of disrupts women's social activism. You know, if we're seeing ourselves as objects, we tend to be kind of more passive. And so I think absolutely this kind of work of really engaging girls in, you know, critical thinking and looking beneath the surface of things and really challenging the descriptions, the stereotypes and constructs is a way to kind of, you know, challenge and push back that is absolutely necessary for girls to be healthy in this culture, I think, especially the culture of sexualization.
And Lynn, before we let you go, what is your hope for the future of girl-powered activism?
My hope is that a lot more adults get involved in this, and that particularly a lot more schools and teachers get involved. Because I feel like, you know, when girls and boys are really, you know, identifying the places that they're hurt and identifying the places that they feel are unjust, and they have adults engaging with them on making those changes, we can really make our schools and communities better places.
Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Lynn Michael Brown, Professor of Education and Director of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Colby College in Maine. And she's the author of the book, Powered by Girl, a Field Guide for Supporting Youth Activists.
Here's a situation you might be familiar with. You go shopping for some clothes. You go from one store to another. You're still the same person, same size, but the clothing size that was too small in store A is too big in store B.
And that might be because of vanity sizing, a practice that assigns smaller sizes to clothes to appeal to customers who want a boost from wearing that smaller size. In a world where being thinner is often equated with being attractive, especially for women, the smaller number on the tag might make some shoppers feel better about themselves, but it can also make shopping really difficult for people. Here's a clip from the show Inside Amy Schumer, where Schumer goes to a trendy retail store in search of a shirt.
Can I help you find something?
Do you have this in a larger size?
Have what in what?
This shirt in a larger size.
Have you checked under the table?
No.
Good luck.
No, these are even smaller.
Could you keep your voice down? You're scaring the thinner customers.
Sorry. I just need just this in a size 12.
Like a UK 12, which is a US 8? Or like a Japanese 12, which is an American toddler 3.
Eliana Docterman is a culture writer for Time magazine in New York City. She wrote about her own experience shopping for clothes and about the history behind sizing. Her article, One Size Fits None, is posted on the Central Time Facebook page. Eliana, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, lead us into how you decided to follow this issue.
Well, so we had been having conversations, my editors and I, for a long time about frustrations with shopping, how we seem to be one size in one pair of jeans and a completely different size in another pair of jeans. And the conversation sort of picked up, actually, when Amy Schumer was included in Glamour's issue of plus-size women embracing different body types. And she got into a back and forth with them where she said, this is great that you're doing this, but I'm a size 8, and that's not plus size. And so we started to talk about the lexicon that we use around sizing and the numbers around sizing and trying to figure out why there isn't just one standardized sizing across all of the U.S., and I began to look into it, and it turns out the reason is it's incredibly complicated to try to assign sizing to people. And so there's so many variety of body types, especially for women and especially in the U.S., where we have so many different types of people and so many different types of bodies that it's impossible to have just one universal sizing system that everyone can follow. So what you end up with is you might be a size 2 in one store and a size 8 in another.
Yeah, and on one hand, this is a frustrating nuisance for people shopping. And on the other hand, as you point out, this blurs into issues over things like body image and expectations of how women dress and what they look like. This is an interesting, annoying issue with some serious consequences, it sounds like.
Yeah, it does have some serious consequences. Part of the problem is vanity sizing. Just to give you a sense of how bad vanity sizing is, which is making the label on the piece of clothing with a smaller number, even though it might have been the same size, the same measurements as it was a few years ago. Twiggy wore a size 8 in 1967. And now somebody like Mindy Kaling has been open about being a size 8. So that's the difference. You know, Twiggy was a model who was known for being extremely thin. Size 8 used to be the smallest size available in the U.S. That's a size 00 today by the same measurements. So the sizes have been shrinking in order to appeal to women because they feel good when they're in a smaller size. But it also helps perpetuate this idea that smaller is better, which isn't necessarily the case.
And does it look like this is an intentional effort from people who design and market clothing, this vanity sizing?
Yes, absolutely. I spoke to people within the industry, professors at fashion schools, who talk about how there is still this idea within the fashion community that they are designing for a certain type of body type, and that body type is almost always very thin, white woman. So that is the body that they are designing for. And the fashion industry has had a hard time thinking about diversity in many different types of ways, in its advertisements, in the way that it designs clothing, in the people that it's marketing to. And so they've had a hard time embracing women who are curvier. So that's been a big problem for them, and I think that the transition's starting to happen. One of the people that I spoke to was Melissa McCarthy, who, along with being this movie star, had this experience where she was going on sets and they were having to Frankenstein clothes for her together because she couldn't find something that was flattering and that fit that she wanted to wear on screen. And, you know, there is a troop of people who just look for clothes for these stars to wear in movies, and they couldn't find anything. And so what she eventually did is she started making her own clothes, and then she launched her own clothing line. And she said, when I spoke to her, I don't understand why, more designers don't launch clothing lines that include larger sizes, because, you know, 67% of American women wear a size 14 or above, and so there's a huge market there.
Let's take a caller. We've got Maddie on the line in Central Wisconsin. Maddie, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Maybe just a little insight with my dealing with the fashion world over the years from the late 50s and 60s. And I was aware that there could be a size 12 in one store, but you go to the high end and a little more exclusive situation and you could be a size 2. But that's been for many, many years. And I kind of think that still holds true because I have some clothes that are size 6 and 2, and I would put myself in the middle range between a 12 and a 14. Now I have items, I feel like taking that size tag and putting it on the outside of the garment. Oh, this is a size 2. I know I'm not a size 2. But indeed, dealing with retailing years back, there would be women coming into a store. Oh, I'm a size 8. Where are the 8s? Well, I would kind of size her up a little bit and think, no, sweetie, I think you need a 12. But if you want an 8, take it to the fitting room. And then she'd come back and say, oh, but it doesn't fit. It's too tight. But it depends on the store you're going to and the price that you're paying. And I think that pretty much holds true today.
Maddie, thanks. I want to get Eliana Doctorman from Time Magazine back in on this. I mean, that was back then. That's now. This is a big chore going from store to store. You take that clothing in the size you think is the right size for you, and who knows what you're going to get in the fitting room.
Right. And we looked at measurements across many different brands, many common brands that people shop for, and found, for example, that a size 6 pair of jeans can vary by as much as 6 inches in the waistband. And if you think about that, that's a tremendous amount. It would be impossible to tell if you were walking into a store you'd never been to before what size you could possibly be. So this has been an ongoing issue for a long time. And the fashion industry doesn't necessarily have the incentive to resolve it because they if you find the brand that you like, you'll stick with that brand and try shopping for that brand. The one thing that may change this, and this is beginning to change, is that people are starting more and more to order clothes online. And it's very frustrating when you order something online and it arrives and it doesn't fit you. And it's impossible to tell without trying it on first whether it's going to fit you or not. We think of that as a small burden to us because we can have free shipping and return it back. But the company that sent it to you has to pay for the shipping, pay to repackage it, pay to inspect the clothes. If the season has changed, maybe it goes on sale. So it's actually a very large cost to them. So they're finally starting to be motivated to try to figure out how to get you into clothes that fit you when you shop online.
Right. I imagine that the technology is there. We can drive a rover around on Mars. It seems like we could come up with a consistent sizing standard for clothing. Why hasn't that happened?
Right. So actually, as with many problems in America, Silicon Valley is trying to hack the problem. So in this case, there have been several startups, many of which I talked to and visited, who are trying to use basically big data to solve this problem. They look at your shopping history, they look at what fit you before, and then they try to pair you with a piece of clothing based not on the size of the clothing, but the actual measurement of the clothing. One of the very popular companies that's doing this is called Truefit. And so Truefit partners with many different stores and sites. Nordstrom's is one of them. And once you go on there, they will ask you, what is your favorite shirt? What brand is it? And what size is it? And based on that, they can tell you which shirt will fit in what size in a different brand.
Right. When I think about it, it seems ridiculous that we try to size people with a one number system because people are different heights, shapes, sizes, weights. They might be the same weight. The weight's proportioned differently. Like, is it even possible to have a one number system that's going to be useful to people?
Right. So part of the problem is that when Americans and the government did try to create a universal sizing system, and they undertook this immense project where they measured thousands and thousands of women. And what they came up with was so many different types of measurements because women can be curvy in so many different ways that there was no real way to distill that into a system that would really work. What they came up with was size 8 through 38, and then they had letters, tall, regular, small, and then symbols, plus or minus. But all of that led to complications for any sort of clothing producer that's trying to create clothing. You know, that's so many different things that you have to create and order and know how much to order, and it's very unwieldy. So what ended up happening is that clothing manufacturers basically reverted back to, okay, we're doing this in a basic 2, 4, 6, 8, 12 sizing system.
We're talking to Eliana Docterman, culture writer at Time Magazine, about the history and present and maybe future of clothes sizing and why it can be so hard to find clothes that fit.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you shop at stores that use maybe this vanity sizing or mark clothes, larger clothes with smaller numbers? How do you think the fashion industry should set the size standards for clothes? And should the fashion industry be expected to contribute to its consumer self-esteem? You can let us know what you think, and if you work in the fashion industry, tell us what your thoughts are on this. 800-642-1234 is the number to call.
Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Eliana Docterman. She's a culture writer for Time Magazine in New York City. She's talking to us about some of the history, the thinking behind vanity sizing and clothes, and why sizes vary so much, and it's hard to find clothes that fit, especially for women.
And we want to know what you think. Do you often find that the size of clothes at retail stores doesn't always match the way they fit? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you ever feel like clothes aren't always made for your body type? And if you shop online, we also want to hear from you. Tell us whether you find it easier or harder to find those clothes that fit you and your body. Our number is 800-642-1234.
Back to our callers now. Mary is with us in Racine. Mary, hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell that I sew, and I made a wedding dress and two bridesmaids' dresses for three young women. And according to the pattern envelope, they were all supposedly the same size, but one was short, one was tall, one was medium, and they had all different shapes mixed in among them, so they were totally different. And the only way to get through it was to fit each dress on each person separately, make the needed alterations. It was a nightmare, but that's how clothing is.
Don't leave us in suspense, Mary. Did it end up working out? Did you end up coming with dresses that fit everybody?
Yes, it worked out well.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Mary. Yeah, so there you go, Eliana, somebody who's making these clothes by hand, realizing you have to really tailor it to particular women.
Right, and that's sort of the interesting thing is that as early as the 1940s and 50s, that was normal to either make your own clothes or tailor your clothes to fit you or have them tailored to fit you. And so this has been a problem really just in the last 50, 60 years where we are buying off the rack and it's no longer the norm for women especially to have clothes tailored. Of course, men tend to have suits tailored. That's a service offered with buying the suit. But for whatever reason, that has not been a part of women's clothing.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Lauren in Marquette, Michigan. Lauren, hi.
Hi. I've been listening to this, and it's interesting because I've wondered. I'm old. I'm 67, and I've wondered for most of my life why women's clothes weren't sized the same as men's are. You know, when you want trousers, you get a waist in inches and a pant length in inches. When you want a shirt, you get a neck in inches, a sleeve length in inches, and a chest in inches. And I've heard you say for the last 10 or 15 minutes that women are all so different.
Mm-hmm.
So why doesn't the industry just measure them?
Lauren, thanks so much for that call. I was a little confused. You said you're old, and then you said you're only 67. But why don't, I mean, if I go buy pants, I have two numbers on it. Still, there's a lack of consistency sometimes, Eliana, but we can do all these things for men. There are shirts you can buy off the rack with those measurements, like you said. Why isn't there more of that for women?
So there are two reasons for that. The first of which is that women's bodies differ in a way that men's bodies don't differ. We have busts, we have hips, different size busts, different size hips, different size waists. So it's more complicated to make a dress for a woman than, say, a shirt for a man and to size that up and down as opposed to a shirt for a man. The other reason is that in this 1958 study throughout the 40s and then which culminated in actual this study in the 1950s, the government measured 15,000 women, and they measured everything from shoulder width to thigh girth. And what they concluded, they had all of these measurements, but one of the things that they found was that women did not like sharing their measurements with store clerks. And you can imagine why. It's similar to having to share your weight, of course. It's so loaded what your measurements are that for women who live in a world where they're judged on how they look all the time, it is a very loaded question to ask a woman what her weight is, let alone what her measurements are.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Eliana Docterman with Time Magazine, talking about clothing sizes, how inconsistent they are, and why that is. We'll go back to our callers now. Michael is on the line in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I identify as a transsexual female. My body, I'm still biologically male, and I fall within the hip-to-waist ratio of a female. And I have a lot of experience sizing the subject of the clothing issue. And what I've decided would work is more of a unisex system where you give a waist measurement, a hip measurement, and a length measurement where a female can go in and simply, or a male, can go in and pick a pair of jeans or a size that simply fits according to measurements. For women, the difference would be slightly in whether it's a high-rise or mid-rise or low-rise waist. That changes quite a bit. And with that said, math doesn't lie. I think it should go back to a system for both men and women where you have a waist measurement, a hip measurement, and a length measurement, and there's no guesswork. And I understand that women want to feel smaller or they're afraid to give sizes, but if you're ordering online or you're ordering where you can't put the clothing on, this is a true measuring type system where you would know exactly what you're getting.
Michael, thanks for sharing your experience and your idea. Would that be something that could work, men and women using the same, this is for pants we're talking now, specifically the same sizing system, Eliana?
So there are a couple of startups that do something like this. One of them is Latote, which only serves women right now, but I believe they're talking about expanding into different types of clothing for all different types of people. But what they do is they have you enter in your measurements, and it's a subscription service, and they will send you clothing each month depending on those measurements. So it's an idea sort of like that, where they are giving you clothes based on measurements as opposed to sizing. I think that near term, that is going to be the solution, is that you have a startup or a separate company that steps in and does the sizing, as opposed to the change in the fashion industry as a whole, because as I kind of mentioned earlier, the fashion industry has been very, very stuck in their ways in how they think about clothing, how they design clothing, and who they're designing clothing for. And I think it would be very hard for one company to step out and say, okay, this is the method that we're going to use to do this, when the other companies are increasingly saying, you're a size 4, you're a size 2, and flattering customers make them feel better. Studies show that people are more likely to feel happy and therefore purchase clothing if they feel smaller in it.
Michael, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Alex with us in Milwaukee. Alex, hi.
Hi. So I've been listening for a while, and I actually heard something about this with Tim Gunn, as far as women who are plus size having a hard time finding clothes and something. I'm only 22 years old, and so when I was younger, I was about 4'8", and I weighed about 130 pounds. And being a 13-year-old girl and already having body dysmorphia problems and having a bad body image, when you are being forced to go into the women's section to find clothes, that just adds on to the types of problems that girls have. And so, especially not only for older women, the fashion industry should try to market clothing better for all types of younger women, because they have those problems starting early, and if they're just compounded by the fashion industry just continuing to make women forced to feel small and be small.
Alex, I want to jump in and give Eliana a chance to respond. Thank you so much, Alex, for sharing your experience. Eliana, briefly, your thoughts on that for girls too, she's saying.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. As she said, Tim Gunn has been very outspoken about this, about the lack of designers who are willing to design for different body types. And lots of, Beyonce has spoken about this, Melissa McCarthy has spoken about this. These are women who are considered some of the most beautiful women in the world. They're actresses and pop stars, and they have trouble finding clothing to fit their bodies. And part of the problem is also when you're going into a store and going into what's often a different section of the store to look for larger sizes, it's often dimly lit. You see a lot of people complaining on social media, especially about how it's dimly lit, how all of the mannequins are still thin. It makes you feel bad about your body. If you try to go shopping with people who are a different size than you, you have to go to a different part of the store than them. It's a very demoralizing experience, and I think especially for young girls.
That's Eliana Docterman. Thanks to her. She's a culture writer for Time Magazine in New York City. We've got her piece on vanity sizing in the fashion industry linked over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And the 2016 Nobel Prize in Literature goes to Bob Dylan.
The Swedish Academy's permanent secretary calls Dylan a great poet in the English-speaking tradition. She compared Dylan's performance work to the Greek poet Homer.
I was kind of surprised by this news this morning. The novelist Haruki Murakami was in the running, along with Philip Roth. An article published in the New Republic on October 6 had the headline, "Who will win the 2016 Nobel Prize in Literature?" Not Bob Dylan, that's for sure.
Whoops. Well, they didn't get that one quite right, but this is surprising. I mean, usually it goes to someone who writes what we think of as literature, and usually that's like novelists or maybe short story authors. a musician, and this is controversial. I've seen some arguments saying people don't read enough. We need to give awards to authors, not songwriters.
I guess the Nobel Committee is flexing the boundaries a little bit, but also obviously looking back at history and saying, well, these poets wrote in works that were meant to be performed, just like Dylan does.
Well, this is Central Time. We'll go out with one of the top picks from the Nobel Prize Committee from Bob Dylan.
The guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blew into my face with scorn.